When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kid's PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino.
That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Cricket is back and in full swing. William Hill is the place to be for cricket punters this year, with a suite of offers across all formats of the game, domestically and internationally. Check out all William Hill's in-play offers, along with all the latest odds and promotions, at williamhill.com or on the free app. 18 plus, please gamble responsibly.
Hello and welcome to Middle Please Umpire. My name is Miles Jupp and I'm joined as ever by Mark Wood, Ashes winner, World Cup winning bowler, Britain in Bloom silver medalist, Ashington's Mr. Pumpkin 2014 to 2016 inclusive. How are you, Mark?
I'm good. How are you, Jobster? I'm working on I'm going to come up with, I think, a few different ones and just see which one you like the best. I'm going to start with Jobster.
Yeah, okay. I've certainly had that jupster. Yeah, they often sort of.
I feel like a jupster's more like a, hey, come on, fella, kind of guy in the field. You have the guy that says fella a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
He would call you jupster.
All right, fella. Yes, there was a sort of period on the stand-up circuit where that's what people, when people were bantering with the front row, they would always call them. All right, fella. What's your name, fella? Anything that you think would be a nice way of encouraging me in the field, Mark, would be quite, come on, that sort of thing. Just could you just get down lower? There's only about three have come to you. Something just sort of gentle.
What about when you're bowling? Have you ever had sort of Jupiter or nice Jupiter out of this world? You see where my head's at?
It's almost a hypothetical. Things would have had to gone very badly. We'd either have to be a very long way ahead in the game, or things to be going very badly for me to be called on, really. Have I told you this about? I remember bowling probably about 15 or 16 ball over when David Troughton, father of Jim, was umpiring.
Son of the actor in Jason and the Argonauts. Knew it well.
That's right. He was umpiring and he's a nice guy and he could see that I'm sort of dreadful. And he was trying to sort of talked me through it as well, but he got to the point where he was actually, you know, sort of, he umpires a lot in the Birmingham leagues or whatever. I'm sure he can be very sort of strict when he needs to be. But he was saying to me, I'd be turning around and walking back to the mark, you know, probably long before the ball had reached the keeper, and he'd be going, I've got to call that one wide. I'm sorry, but I can't not call that wide.
Did you get the famous yips?
The famous yips. Well, I think the thing about having the yips, you've got to have got to a certain level, haven't you, before you can even have the, I didn't, you can't loss, you can't lose something that you've never had.
I love this image of him telling you what to bowl or how to go about it, because that would just make me feel 10 times worse.
Well, there's that thing, isn't there, in there's a really good interview I read with him recently, the bowler that sort of lost his run-up and everything during a final at Lord's.
Oh, yeah. He was born at Triscothic, wasn't he?
That's right, yeah. And there's a really, really good he speaks about it really brilliantly, that guy. And there's a very good interview with him. And he actually explains one of the people that helped him on the pitch during it. Because it's the sort of thing you think, well, of course, why doesn't this happen more? You know, that kind of pressure or whatever. And, you know, it's like it was the umpire talked him through it, actually. Just said, just concentrate on getting your arm as high as you can.
Scott Boswell.
That's right, yeah. And he'd had a really good, you know, tournament up to then or whatever. These things just happen.
If you get the yips, it must be an awful place to be. I remember Dom Sibley bowling for England last year in the pandemic when Root brought him on.
I think I ironed two shirts during that over.
And I remember Wooksy crying with laughter at mid-off. So there was absolutely no sympathy there. And half the team felt sorry for him. The other half just couldn't stop laughing. So it must be quite hard for a captain to go up to somebody and know how to deal with them or what to say. Because I remember Sibbers at the end of that over said, do not bowl me again.
Ever. But also that's, you know, why was he, it wasn't like he was going up to Root at the end of every over going, surely it's time for me now.
Yeah. I think it was out of the blue. I don't think he ever expected to bowl.
When I was about 18, when I was at school, I had a sort of music scholarship. So I was meant to sort of contribute musically. And I didn't really, because I had sort of took my eye off it, really, and I didn't work very hard at it. But I ended up sort of doing bits of percussion. And there was a concert in which I was asked to play the bass drum, right, which is a massive thing, so you've got to get it absolutely right. This piece called the Verdi Requiem, right? And there's this bit where there's only one bit of it that you're really needed for, but you have to get it, and if you get it right, it looks all right. And I did that concert, and it went fine. And so the next term, they were like, right, can you play the cymbals in this other thing? Right at the beginning of the piece, I had to play one big crash. And then nothing happened for like 80 bars. And then I had to play a few more. And so I got up to do the first one. The conductor points to me, crash the cymbals together. It's all in the right place. But I created a gust with the cymbals and the music that was on my stand. When I went crash, just sort of, it flew off. And it just disappeared. And I thought, oh, no, it just sort of went over the heads of someone. Everyone's doing something. You know, they're all playing instruments or whatever. No one can pick it up and bring it to you. And I tried, I don't know why, but I tried to get the conductor's attention that this had happened. And, of course, I'm holding two big cymbals, so I just started waving these cymbals about. And I didn't get his attention, but I got the attention of a lot of people in the audience who were thinking, what is that guy doing? He's gone sort of air traffic control.
And from there was born the YMCA.
But what it then meant was there was a guy playing the timpani, and he was like, don't worry, I'll count you in. And he counted me in perfectly for like 60 or 70 bars. And I pulled my hands back to do the big crash, and he went, you know, gave me the nod, went, now. And I started going to crash them together. And halfway between like my arms being outstretched and the cymbals meeting, in that little tiny moment, I lost confidence and thought, this can't be right, can it? And I tried then to stop the cymbals colliding, which took, I nearly put out both shoulders. And it was incredible. Once you've started moving ahead to try and stop it, these big heavy things are holding. And I probably made a noise as I did it. I absolutely lost. And then I turned around, and the guy that had just devoted so much of his time counting in for me and giving me the nod, he just looked at me with this absolutely astonished expression and sort of started to laugh, which meant me that all I could do, I probably had like six or seven crashes to do before the end of the piece. I delivered none of them whatsoever. I just started to laugh hysterically whilst standing there holding these cymbals behind the soloists, and then I just sat down and put them in and just left my head in my hands for the rest of the concert. But in that moment of feeling, I don't know if I can do this, when you're halfway through doing something, the thought of doing that then when you've got just cameras on you, or you've got a full stadium, I don't know why people don't panic more. You know, it's like that feeling on an aeroplane. How does this thing stay up? What's going on?
It sounds a bit to me like the Sam Curran Mark Wood batting partnership. He guided me through that, and we nearly won the game.
That was how long did you bat for?
Oh, I only faced maybe 16 or 17 balls or something.
Really?
Yeah. Out of like, must have been 10 overs or something like that.
It was very, very reminiscent of Pringle and Derek Pringle and Gooch against the West Indies.
Well, early on, when I came in, it was sort of like, I'll get myself in and then we'll have a go sort of thing. And then I think after I faced a few balls, I think Sam thought he can take it on rather than me contribute and waste balls. So he just said, look, I'll take the strike. If we're going to win, I'll need to hit fours and sixes. I mean, I was happy to have a go, but actually, for a guy that's hardly played any games in such a young age to take that on and think, I've got the confidence to do that. I remember at the end of the game, Moggy was laughing because obviously with no crowd and anyone in, he could hear what we were saying in the middle. And I was like, the guy at the other end saying, keep your head down, Sam.
High elbow.
Yeah, as I'm parked on my bat at the other end, I was like, oh, keep your head down, Sam. Good shapes, good shapes. And he's like sort of like nodding as if like, yeah, all right, man, I know what I'm doing. You're the guy I'm protecting here.
You know this is my job, Mark. Yeah, he's got a, because I was listening, well, at the beginning of that day, I went out for a run in the morning and I was listening to the commentary. And of course, they would think, it's really hot here. And you were bowling at that stage and putting in, you know, serious effort in the heat. And I just had these commentators keep saying, look at that, it looks, oh my word, it's hot out there. Look, that looks hard work. And I was running around the park here, which was still had sort of mist hanging over it. And then that partnership, by the time you came out to bat, I mean, it did seem, with the best one in the world, like a sort of lost cause. And I was, by that point, Mark, in my exciting day, I'd moved on to stripping some wallpaper. And I was stripping this wallpaper around a fireplace, and I got all the way down to the sort of bottom left-hand side, and then you suddenly started, it looked like we could win it. And I became superstitious, and there was a bit that I'd finished, but because it was the bit that I was doing when it was going well, like, you know, seats in the dressing room, I thought, I can't move from here. So I ended up repeatedly steaming and scraping a bit of wall that had no wallpaper left on it whatsoever down on my haunches for about 50 minutes. What are you doing? Haven't you done that bit? Like, I can't move from here. I can't move from here. It's going really, it's going really, we're just slowly filling the sitting room with steam. How did you get through that bowling spell? That was, I mean...
It was tough. I think mentally you've just got to, you know, think how lucky you are. I'm playing for England. You know, this is another game for England, another game to win for England against India.
Every cloud,
This is a crunch match. I think that the way that, to describe it to people at home listening, the way that I felt was, it was like I hadn't eaten enough. It was like I felt a little bit wobbly, a bit weak, a bit sort of tingly and just a bit rubbish. I felt not very well. And then Stokes said to me, look, after my first three overs, go off. We're going to need you to bowl. So get cooled down, get yourself in a better place and come back. So I went off. The doctor had bizarrely put alcohol gel all over my back and put me underneath a...
I know what you're going to say.
Air conditioner.
Oh, I thought you were going to say one of those old things for ladies to have their perms done in old-fashioned hair.
No. So he put me under that to keep me cool, which worked well. And then he put a towel filled with ice on my back and watered the towel so I was freezing cold. And he says he could feel the heat coming through the towel. So I must have been just overheated and felt really ill. It wasn't until I went back on, I started to feel a little bit better. The energy came back a little bit. I'd had toast with honey. I'd had an infinity amount of Gatorade. So
bit of time with your slippers on.
Yeah, so I felt a little bit better. I went out, started to bowl again. And of course, as soon as I started to bowl again, I started to feel ill again. I would run in as hard as I could, pick your legs up, drive towards the target, bowl the ball. And then I would feel awful, horrendous walking back to my mark. And then the same thing would get right turn. Right, come on, pick your legs up, drive your head forward. And that was the sort of process where I would just sort of think, right, get back to your mark. And then I could go through my sort of methods of my head of what I was trying to get through. But that walk back was like the long walk back. And it seemed to be like my run-up just kept getting longer and longer and longer because I just was feeling a little bit ropey. But
I suppose it's like getting through a West End matinee when you've got a hangover. If I can just draw briefly on personal experience, you know, you've got to just
do your job. That's it, isn't it? Just do it. Crack on.
Right now, what I'm going to do? I'm going to open up the mail bag. We've been asking various questions. Okay, so in the Joe Root episode, I told a story that I think changed Mark's life about spotting Joe Root at a branch of Euro Garage near me. So we put the question out: have you spotted any first class cricketers at petrol stations? I suppose the idea really is that, you know, we can start to build up a map of who goes where, why, you know, start to analyse their behaviour and maybe uncover, I don't know, maybe one of them will turn out to be Banksy or whatever if we follow the clues right. So, Matt Tufts, he spotted Ronnie Irani at Clackett Lane Services back in 2018. I'm sure there's a story there. Will Carson, he saw Sam Billings at the BP in Malvern Road, Worcester, also in 2018. Well, that already there's a coincidence. He says he immediately texted his teammates at Keeville CC and no one was particularly interested. Well, I'm glad that we've provided another outlet for that spot. Jonathan Winsome, I couldn't contain my excitement when the topic of cricketers at petrol stations cropped up on your entertaining podcast, as I've seen not one but two relatively successful players filling up their sponsored vehicles. The first was the Australian Chris Rogers at a Shell garage in, wait for it, Telford, when he played for Wellington. The second was Matthew Fleming at the Abingdon services near Edinburgh. Not being at all good at striking up conversations with people that I recognise but don't actually know, I'm afraid that on both occasions there was no social interaction whatsoever, not even a well played. I also saw Carl Hooper in a post office once and made... I love this sentence. I also saw Carl Hooper in a post office once and made no attempt to speak to him either. Oh, fantastic.
First class, Carl.
Very good. Ben Mendoza. Sometime in the 90s, I was coming back from a rave and stopped at South Mim Services on the A1 north of London. To my surprise, I saw Brian Lara coming out of the canteen with a woman on each arm. I winked to him and he winked back. Wow, that's a great way of just colliding there with the 90s rave scene there. Of course, it's amazing, you know, the way that everything interconnects like this.
That sounds like a scene from Wedding Crashers, that.
Yeah.
Brian Lara came up with one girl in each arm and a wink to the guy that winked to him. Fantastic, that.
Extraordinary. And he's like, well, I'm going to, you know, let's take the South Mims. Let's do these things properly. Matthew Jones, it wasn't a cricket player at a service station, but I drew great amusement from seeing Glenn Maxwell shunning the player's tee on offer in the pavilion at Colwyn Bay when Lancashire visited Glamorgan in 2019, instead choosing to queue up for a burger from a van still in his whites. And there is indeed a picture there that is, and the other people in the queue look, I can't work out if they're ignoring him or look rightly baffled that someone playing in the game has just wandered off to buy a burger. This is from Alexander Holt Evans, who actually managed a conversation. Escapism is the order of the day at the moment, so thank you both enough for scooping me up from my lockdown schedule and placing me in these far safer environment of petrol stations in suburban Wales. Upon hearing of your riveting encounter with Sheffield's finest wielder of the willow, I was immediately reminded of a similar seismic encounter between myself and England's current T20 and world number one batsman. During a long drive from home in Suffolk to Edinburgh a few years ago, I stopped off at Wetherby Services to indulge myself with some premium unleaded and a zesty power drink. Whilst holding up an end on pump four, I turned my head to see who else but the bearded England fringe player at the time, David Milan. Seeing the destructive number three climbing out of his Kia in his full England kit was a moment I'll never forget, and I was plunged into a state of awkward nervousness, tinged with the excitement of a possible signature or exchange of pleasantries. I bided my time, pretending to continue filling up despite having long since brimmed the tank, and followed David from the forecourt into the kiosk. I lurked behind the England star, thinking that since he was in his full training kit, a word or two with a fan wouldn't come as a surprise. I said to him, "Great game last night, David. Shame about Gale." The universe boss had steamrolled England up in Durham the night before. Milan turned sharply quick. "The guy sure hits a clean ball." We shared a chuckle. He turned, paid for his Oasis, and pumped three. Love these details. Paid for his Oasis and pumped three and left for London. My ability to remain calm under such pressure gave me huge confidence, and I'm a changed man since. Petrol stations are where dreams come true, a school of thought Miles is no doubt familiar with.
That's brilliant, that one.
Thank you very much for those. I had no idea that we would get such an extraordinary response and an incredible array. So we're starting to basically build up a picture of where cricketers have been spotted at petrol stations.
The underground network of services.
We need to kind of set up like, you know, like an investigations room, like they have in Line of Duty or The Wire or something, and start getting, you know, get a map on the wall, some pictures, some rooms, work out who goes where and when, and we can basically spot the connections and solve this.
For the lads in the north, Wetherby and Woodall are the two popular ones. Leicester Forest's a good one because it's halfway down. I dare say that Gloucester Services is the best that I've been to.
That's a very that's run by the same people that run Tebow, isn't it? That's very good. I mean, I suppose we're like Membry. I go to quite often if I'm driving back from London. Hopwood Park. That is where I go. That's halfway between me and my parents. So very very familiar with what the guys at Hopwood Park do. And guys, I remain incredibly impressed with your service. And indeed your commitment to it. Excellent. Well, that is the mailbag. Now, thanks very much, everyone who's written in. Right, well, it's time for us to welcome a guest to Middle Please Umpire now. Are you aware of who our guest this week is, Mark?
No. I mean, is he, I don't know, a breed of dog or something?
Is he a breed... he is indeed former Gloucestershire wicketkeeper, Bernie's Mountain. No, it's Jack Russell.
I'd just like to take a moment to thank our founding sponsors, Cricketer's Gin. Cricketer's Gin is the perfect podcast partner, as this corker of a gin began its innings at the local village cricket club in Pinckney's Green, Berkshire. Over a G&T, the founders decided that this quintessential British game, along with the wild botanicals growing in abundance, deserved a bespoke gin of its own. Cricketer's features milk thistle, wild marjoram, and blackberries, amongst other botanicals, delivering a smooth, juniper-forward gin. If pink is your preference, they also have a delicious, raspberry-distilled pink gin. Please take a look at their website, cricketersgin.com, where you'll find a range of gin hampers too. Apply the code CRICKET, and you'll receive a discount off your purchases. Cricketer's, a small batch gin and a family-owned business.
William Hill's safer gambling tools help you stay in control. You can set deposit limits, session reminders, and take timeouts whenever you need them. 18 plus, please gamble responsibly. William Hill, it's who you play with.
Stump David, great work. Beautiful piece of work. That's what he was there for. Wakeside stumping. 50 wickets for Bradston Small. That was all Jack Russell's wicket, that one. That was a fine piece of club work.
So we're delighted to be joined by our next guest, who is Gloucestershire and England great Jack Russell. Hello, Jack.
Hi, guys. Good to talk to you.
How are you today?
I'm very good. It's a normal painting day for me, so if I'm painting, I'm happy. If I'm happy, my wife's happy, so there's no arguments, and we just crack on.
Are you in your sort of painter's? I don't know if you wear a sort of a beret to paint in, or do you have like a pair of overalls?
Not exactly. No, I was Mark, I tell you, I was never the tidiest dresser, so I look like a bit of a ragbag, but I'm just covered in paint, so because most of it's on me rather than the canvas, so I'm doing something wrong somewhere. But I look like multicoloured jacket.
Miles, I'm a bit disappointed. I thought that was the perfect opportunity for Jack to bring in. I wear me floppy. I wear the old school floppy even when I paint. I thought that was it. I thought it was coming.
Do you know what, Mark? It actually flashed into my head that. As soon as you mentioned hats, it did come in, yeah. But I don't, it's in such a fragile state now. It's probably, if I was playing today, health and safety wouldn't allow it. I mean, it's actually a bit of a health hazard. So I try not.
It's probably a major vector of disease.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, talking about viruses, I mean, this would be, you know, it would be terrible. And the inside's still burnt from when I burnt it once, so... It's not great on the inside, and it's not that good on the outside anymore.
How many of your first-class games did you wear that hat for?
Every single game. I had it the first day, my first day at Gloucestershire as a professional was 1982. I played one game the year before when I was still at school doing my A-levels. I played a first-class game against the tourists, the Sri Lankans, and then joined the club full-time the following year. And I had it given to me first day by the late Tony Brown, and I kept it ever since. And it's sort of gone through many metamorphoses in terms of repairs, etc. But I managed to make it last until the... I did have one period with England in the West Indies where they made me wear the tour issue hat, which was a hard brim thing, which would give you a headache after about an hour in the field. So apart from that, I wore it just about, well, certainly every other first-class game.
I know this, Miles. I know this story already. So I spoke to Mergs, who was here as our team media man, and he was telling me about a meeting they had in the West Indies where they tried to make everybody look the same. You had to have the same helmets, the same kit. Obviously, some was in the MCC, some was wearing the jumpers, some was wearing different caps, different coloured helmets.
And they reckon that one of the major meetings was about your hat. Is that not right, Jack?
Well, embarrassingly, yes, that is true. Because Lord McLaurin was head of, just come into the ECB, and he was a little bit worried that, you know, one guy was wearing a white floppy, one guy was batting in a blue hat, one guy, Nasser, was batting in his white hat, Stu had a white helmet. And it got to this, and we looked a bit of a, from a, a corporate point of view, we looked a little bit tatty and a bit rough. We weren't exactly winning many games either, I don't think now. But having said that, we were told that we had to wear the team issue equipment. And I got selected for that tour. I'd been out for a year or two. And I was told I had to wear my wear the issued hat, the big wide hard brim thing, you know, like a Mexican hat. And I thought, oh, they're not serious. When we get out, so we got out there. We got to the West Indies before the first practice game in Montego Bay, and there were two or three meetings leading up to that, team meetings. I mean, you ask Athers about it, Mike Atherton, he just shakes his head because he can't believe they spent so much time talking about a hat. And basically, I was told that, and I spent about 3 days on the phone to the solicitor as well, by the way, which cost me a fortune. I was told that if I didn't wear the hat, Bumble, David Lloyd, the coach, and Mike Atherton would be sacked, and I would be sent home. And that was the line.
No way.
That was true. That was the exact line. So I had a bit
of all the problems facing English cricket in the 90s, the idea that people's hats weren't matching.
Never mind facing the West Indies and thinking, oh, let's hit the top of off. It's Jack's hat. That's the main talking point here.
I wasn't allowed in the team meetings because they had to discuss my hat, not in front of me. So I would spend hours sat in my hotel room waiting to find out what the plan was. Anyway, it came to in the end that the annoying thing was my hat was tidier than the hats they were giving me at the time, because at the start of every tour, the hat used to be washed and repaired. It would go into the airing cupboard and it would be put over a tea cozy, a tea towel, and left in the airing cupboard for a couple of days. It looked spanking brand new. And so I was a little bit annoyed about that. Anyway, they forced me into it. So I got a letter. I've still got the letter somewhere from the manager. I've got it in writing that I would be allowed to wear the big wide brimmed hat, but I'd be allowed to cut the hat down to the same brim as mine, because I didn't want a floppy brim in front of me while I was keeping wicket. It's hard enough trying to catch the ball as it is. So basically, I got a handwritten letter. But after we walked out of Montego Bay and my hat was cut down, it looked like my old hat initially. Mike Atherton nearly had a heart attack. He went white. He thought I'd put my old hat back on and he was going to get the sack. Till he got close up to me and realised I'd cut the new hat down. And then basically, after about two games, it was tattooed than my hat. So it looked worse than mine. So in the end, it sort of defeated the object. I had the worst tour of my life, by the way.
Entirely hat-related?
Well, I don't know. Only subconsciously, possibly, because it was like part of my soul, really. Even now, these days, I've got to know where it is 24 hours a day, otherwise I have a panic attack.
It does seem like an enormous distraction. Now, I suppose those days you were touring with quite a sort of skeleton staff, Mark and his lot. I mean, there's presumably several designated hat people. In fact, there's probably a couple of hat people who are away on paternity leave, something like that, Mark. So some other hat people have had to come in. I mean, how many designated hat people are there in the England backroom staff these days?
Well, no hat carriers. We have got, I think, 17 backroom staff on tour. We do have a hat box now, which gets presented, and which is a lovely thing. The last guy that makes his debut, he presents the next cap box to the next guy, and it's got your number and your name on. So that's a lovely touch, I think, that Rudy brought in. Even, I'm sure Jack could even put his hat in his hat box and that wouldn't have even been an issue. So, that's a nice touch.
I find, Jack, in the 90s, to me, was my sort of where the end I got into cricket, and I associate you with so many sort of astonishing, iconic moments, I think. And not just as a keeper, because you were sort of unparalleled, I think. But I was thinking about some your batting, for instance, the ability you had to come in when things were absolutely shocking. Old Trafford, 95, when we were 48 for 4. Robin Smith, probably the best player of short, fast bowling, has been hospitalised. What goes through your head when you're going out? John Crawley's sort of scratching around from number 3, he's still in. And then you went out and just absolutely smacked it, what, 31 off 39, and brought it home very calmly.
You make it all sound very colourful, and like I did millions of brilliant things. But that particular game, I remember walking past, I was next in, and Robin Smith, as you said, got hit in the face, and his cheekbone wasn't where nature intended it to be, and it was sort of round by his left ear a little bit. And I remember walking past him. He was being helped off by Dave Roberts, the physio, who was a bit dazed. Now, Robin Smith was one of the toughest players, hard players that I ever played with. So for him to be even in, you know, he would play with broken fingers, that guy. He was unbelievable. I remember walking past him and thinking, well, we're chasing 90-odd here. John Craw is the other end. And I said to Creepy when I went out, Creeps, just stick around. Just you stay in your end, mate, and I'll see what I can do. And I was a bit pumped up anyway, and I just got back in the team, actually. I'd been out for a little while, and I was playing a sort of aggressive game anyway, because I got back in the team because Ray Linworth watched me play the week before at Cheltenham, and I got 90-odd attacking, and when we were about 40 for 5 or 6 in that game as well against Lancashire. So I was in that groove, really, where I just sort of played shots, and I like attacked more than I've sort of tended to play quite stubborn over my career, but in this particular game, I thought I'm just going to go for it. And it's actually one of the proudest moments in my career. It's actually hooked. I thought it was hooked. I saw the highlights recently. It was a pull, not a hook. Kirtley Ambrose, who I never hit a boundary off in my life. And suddenly I was so pumped up, and I just, with bat speed, I just managed to hook it, and it just went down the boundary for four. And Creepy stayed the other end and just knocked it around a little bit, and I just played my shots. And they were attacking anyway with the field, because they had to take wickets. So there were plenty of gaps. So I just put bat to ball. It was either a cut or a pull, because you didn't get many drives off the West Indies. And it just happened to be a day that came off. And I remember coming off just another magic day at Old Trafford, which, you know, I always used to enjoy playing at.
Because that sort of chips are down thing. I mean, your century you scored against India, you came in when we were 107 for 5.
God, you've got a good memory, Miles.
I've got Google, Jack.
Oh, that's okay.
Wait, you get to the Bob McLaughlin. You're not there yet. We're getting to the mic. I feel like it's a build up of McLaughlin's coming to the male favourite player.
Okay, I'll look forward to that bit. Sorry, Miles, what was the question again? I've forgotten.
it was just that ability then to, you know, when if you're batting at 7, it would be easy to think that the tone of the innings is set there, and when you've got the tail behind you. So the mindset necessary to come in at 107 for 5, say, and that to be the moment that you score a century. I mean, how does that work out for you mentally?
Well, the thing is, basically batting at 7 is you've got, you know, there are sort of several scenarios you can come into. You either got a load of runs on the board and you've got to get on with it for a declaration, etc., or you're struggling and you've got to sort of decide whether you're going to dig in or counterattack, or you're batting with the tail. So it's sort of like I played that position right throughout my career, even playing in county cricket. So I got used to sort of the different types of situations. And you basically, it's like a game of chess, really. You've got to work out what you're going to do, whether you're going to attack, whether you're going to just stay in. And it's just, you just get into, you just play it as you see it at that particular time. And the innings at Lord's, actually batted with Graham Thorpe, which I didn't bat that many times with, and we were 5 down for 80, I think, on a green seamer, or it seemed like a green seamer to me anyway at the time, the way I kept playing and missing. But I just thought I'd attack at that situation as well, and luckily I managed to get to the end of play, and I can't remember what I was overnight, maybe 40 or 50, maybe 60, and then just put on another 60-odd in the next day, and that's a special moment, because that's when you... A lot of great players, and I'm talking, my batting was pretty average, but yeah, when I'm talking great players that are not on those honours boards at Lord's, to actually manage to get on there with 100 is like a schoolboy dream come true.
I want to ask about Old Trafford there, like you mentioned. I know that when I play now, we look straight down the wicket, whereas when you played, Jack, the wicket would have been the other way. So actually coming against the West Indies and people like that, and Joe Berg's the same, which I'm sure Miles will ask you about later. But watching side on, what were you like before you went out to bat? Did you watch the game? Were you calm? Were you just waiting to see until he got out there? Like, what? How did you feel watching at places like that?
I'll be honest with you, watching guys like yourself who bowl like 90 odd 100 miles an hour, from square on is not the most ideal way of doing it. It's not the best preparation, really. When I played as often as I could, even in county cricket, I would always go and stand near or sit near the score, the sight screen for a period of time, just to get down at eye level. Because Old Trafford, you're way above, those dress rooms are way at the top, and even now they are. The old pavilion, they were above. So you don't get a gist of the way the ball's behaving, really, and the way the length. I didn't know what I was doing it at the time, but it was a visualisation, really, watching the opposition bowlers and getting something into my head about who was doing what and what the wicket was doing and the way the ball was coming down. You didn't always get that at places like Old Trafford. So I always preferred to watch from behind, down by the sight screen. That would be my ideal place to watch. In county cricket, you could do that. And that, for me, gave me the best visual of what was going on, because I find that batters that just wander out there and see what happens, you know, you're not giving yourself the best chance. So with my little ability, I had to give myself the best chance possible. So I need to know everything that was going on. Not a lot of players are like that. Some just like to just wander out and play it, you know, as they see it. And we're all different. But I just like to view it that way. Old Trafford, when I went back to paint there in 2019... and they changed the pitch around. Actually, you were sat behind me in the media centre. I was up on the balcony painting. I think you were doing some radio. You were just behind me, actually.
You were just literally in front of me.
Yeah, I was. And you could see what I was doing. And then they seemed such a different ground to me, you know, not being square on. It seemed really odd. I mean, I still love the ground, but from the pavilion from the side in the old days, it's just got I used to walk off to that standing ovation if you'd done well. It was a magic time for me.
In the 90s, if you're... You know, you're coming in at seven quite often. That would be during an England collapse, wouldn't it? And you'd be the one with your eye in, because you'd have, you know, you'd have been in the field for 90 overs.
Yeah, you just, yeah. I mean, and also you didn't have much time to have a cup of tea and get your old gear off. And sometimes I'd put my batting pads on quite quick as well. So you don't always. No offense to my fellow ex-teammates. It's a different thing, because you do get a view of what the pitch is doing. You do get that, and you get computer conditions, great. But every bowler is different, you know, and you need to see what the other bowlers are doing. So I used to try and pick up as much information as I could from actually just watching them from the behind the sight screen. You'd watch a bit of telly if you weren't too worried about, you know, you wouldn't mind watching a replay just to see exactly what balls are doing. If it was going all over the place, we'd probably switch the telly off.
And we should probably talk about the Wanderers then, not because Mark's such a big Mike Atherton fan. he'll be raring for this. But that match, of course, the two things about that game is that you took 11, well, you made 11 dismissals in that game. So I mean, that period is sort of, you know, it's such a great run of form there, 95, 96. So you'd already, by the time you went out to bat on that last day, you'd already set a world record, hadn't you, with your gloves on. But you, I mean, honestly, how much confidence could you have walking into that situation?
Well, the thing was, Mark, you've played at Johannesburg, haven't you?
I got a few runs there. I can't really remember. So I don't live on it.
You played there. I mean, it's like a bit of a ball ring, isn't it? You walk down to the pitch, and when we were playing there, there used to be a tin roof on the stand next to you as you walk down, and I can still hear that being bashed and bashed and bashed on the top. It was like deafening, you know, walking out. They're trying to intimidate you. And in those days, because I take it as a bit of a compliment, really, as I walked to the wicket, they would make dog noises, or woof whistle noises, and like pretend like, I used to get that all the time. So that used to like spur me on a bit. So just getting out to the wicket, and as you said, I got the world record the day before, or was it that morning? No, it was the day before, yeah, the fourth day. And I just one thing about that, as I remember, I couldn't sleep the night before because I think I needed one more catch the next day. I think it was one or two. I couldn't sleep the night before. And I remember sitting up all night in my hotel room, bar about 2 hours kip, just watching a lightning storm the whole night and drinking tea. That was my match preparation for the fourth day, which was not probably ideal. So come the last day, I was pretty exhausted in terms of not having a lot of sleep and not recovering particularly that well. And I got to the wicket and... remember that Mike Atherton had already been batting. This is like the last morning, first session. I can't remember what time I got in. Robin Smith got caught third man, cut in. I remember that. I thought that was good. Yeah, that's good, Judge. That was a good shot. You know, we're trying to save the game. He goes and blasts it down a third man's throat. I remember thinking that. And then, but when I got to the wicket, Athers had already been batting since lunchtime the day before. So we're nearly lunchtime now on the last day. And I looked into his eyes and I thought, this guy's going to do this. This guy is actually going to do this. You know, I could see in his look in his eye that there was no way that, and they were throwing the kitchen sink at him and the whole house and everything at him, by the way, Donald and Pringle and McMillan, they were trying to kill him. They'd been trying for a day nearly, and he was still there. And I thought, well, somebody's got to pull the finger out here and stay the other end. So my target really at that point was to be naught not out at the end of play. Now, if I bore the world to tears and send everybody to sleep, I don't care. If I'm naught not out at the end of play, I've done my job, because I know Athers is going to stay in the other end. I knew he was going to do that. That was the vibes I was getting from him straight away. How I got to 29 not out, I do not know. I hit four later on, and I had to give myself the biggest rollicking I've ever given myself. What are you doing hitting a four, Russell? For God's sake, you're just supposed to be blocking.
But you carved it over third man.
Sorry, no. I just set out. It was easy. When you analyse it, my game plan was so simple. I was just going to block straight down the pitch, duck and weave out of anything that's in the way, and leave everything else. And apparently I got to one point where I think I took 40, it was about 50-odd minutes without scoring a run, and I was very close to beating Godfrey Evans's record of not scoring a run for so many minutes in a test match or something like that. Somebody mentioned that to me after. I missed it by a couple of minutes. So my game plan was simple, Miles. It wasn't complicated. It was just block every ball and send everyone to sleep, really.
Well, I just have such fond and vivid memories of it. An extraordinary, extraordinary thing, really. And I is it one of those things that you carry around with you? I mean, now you do such a different thing, I suppose. You're immersed in your painting. But do you ever stop and just sort of disappear off into a reverie, like Mark does about the time that he hit whoever it was for a six back over his head? Who was it again, Mark? I've only heard.
I can't remember. You're not going to get that out of me now, Miles. That's it.
But do you find yourself drifting off into a reverie, Jack, and just suddenly, you know, you just suddenly hear them banging on the metal shed as you go out there, or hear the whistle?
I'll be honest with you. There are two things that get mentioned to me more than anything. One is, have you still got the hat? Which I have. And the other thing is, I remember you in Johannesburg with Athers. I mean, those are the two most, and then people say, what was it like? And that was the two most mentioned things in my life from my career. So it's just great to, I'm just so proud that we managed to, I'm a little bit, we ended up joint man of the match, which I sort of keep apologising to Athers for, because we ended, I mean, his was a brilliant 180-odd not out, and he deserved man of the match. And I spoiled it a bit for him. He had to share the bottle of champagne with me in the man of the match check. So I still apologise to him for that. But it was like when we came off, and I remember there were two things that stick in my head at the end. Daryl Hare, the Australian umpire, was umpiring, and he took the bails off. And I looked at him, and I was with such a dirty look, I nearly said to him, what the hell are you doing? What are you doing taking the bales off? I said, me and others are going to bat here for a week here. Just put them back on. I was in such a zone. I was that pumped up that I just didn't. And then at dawn, oh, crikey, we've done it. You know, we're great. And then we wandered off, and we got mobbed coming off, which was amazing. There was loads of England fans there. One of the early trips with the English Barmy, you know, the Barmy Army, that was great. Got back to the dressing room, it was like we'd won. And we got back to the dressing room, and Athers sat in one corner, I sat in the others, we're both knackered, and we just looked at each other, and he raised his glass to me. I think I probably had a mug of tea or something, I raised that. This other thing, quickly, during the day, and I was a little bit superstitious at times, and I was going, like you said, going through a good patch with the bat. In between overs, I'd tap, as it became a superstition during that period, I would tap my partner's pad. So if in between overs, have a chat, how you doing, yeah, keep going, blah, 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 tap a pad, go back to non-strike zone. Well, if I forgot to do it, I would run down the other end and I would tap Athers' pad and run back. I mean, the South Africans must have thought I was a complete nutcase. And I kept saying to him, in between overs, I kept saying, remember Barbados, remember Barbados. And he kept saying, okay, I remember Barbados. Right, okay, I'll remember it. We'll keep going. But Barbados was in 1990 when we should have saved it on the last day. I batted most of the last day as night watchman, and I got out about 40 minutes before the end of play. And then we got the last five wickets went in about 10 minutes, and we lost by about 20 minutes. And I was so determined not to go through that pain again. I kept saying to him between overs, "Others remember Barbados." He kept saying, okay, Jack, I remember Barbados. So we're sat in the change room at the end, and he's looking at me and I'm looking at him. We're sort of like thumbs up to each other. And then he said to me, "Jack, Barbados. I didn't even play in Barbados." I said, "No, but it kept me going, though, didn't it?" And it did. And it was the Barbados thing that kept me going. And I didn't want to go through that pain again.
I've gone in hard on your batting. But let's talk about your keeping then. As a keeper, did you prefer keeping to pace bowling or to spin?
I preferred up to the stumps, really, if I'm honest. I mean, stood back, I was okay. I did all right, stood back. My core stability wasn't great, so I had back problems towards the end. So I wasn't the strongest person stood back. But stood up was, I was brought up having been told, you know, you learn your trade, stood up to the stumps. That's the place where you do the real business. No offence to Mark, by the way.
None taken, Jack.
So stood up to the stumps was the thing for me. And people say, oh, it's great to stand up to the quicks and the medium paces, and that was always great. But the toughest bit, the real mental discipline comes with the spinners, when you've got to stay in position, and especially on pitches that aren't doing a great deal. The pitches we've seen in India recently have been easy, for me, mentally, would be easy to keep on, because the balls, there's something happening all the time, so they sharpen you up. You know you've got to be on the 100% on the ball. The harder pitches for me were when the ball didn't come to me for 3 hours, or I might have to wait till like the end of a day's play before I got a catch, and that sort of thing. They're mentally tougher. The wickets we've seen in India are more physically demanding, and you've got to be really electric fast.
So, Jack, what would you do training wise? I mean, I've seen our lads, Joss, Folksy, Johnny, they do things with harnesses to obviously get their body weight going one way and work against that. They do a lot of one hand drills. They do a lot of stuff where they dive off the bowler machine, and a lot of it like core stability, the head and the hands, like good foot movement. Was there anything you trained or did training wise that was particularly helpful?
You see, we didn't. When I was 18 or 19 as a teen, I wish I'd done ballet. That might sound crazy, but the thing about ballet is you've got to have really good core stability. And if my core stability had been better, I would have played another 5 years, I think, at the end. I would have been quicker and a bit stronger, and I wouldn't have got so many fatigued. Also, we used to diet on steak and chips, which is not like the most healthiest thing to do, so, and have a few pints as well in the early days. So our diets weren't great easiest. But I used to do a guy from Australia called Tony Blaine, I think his name was. He was a keeper over there. He taught me plyometrics. So in the winters, I would do frog leaps up the stairs, drive my wife and my kids nuts. But I would those leaps like a frog, and things like that. We didn't have the scientific technology that you've got now, so we just had to make our own things up and work out the best way to get our bodies ready. I remember my first tour to Pakistan, which was 1987. I'd not been to I'd been to Sri Lanka before, and I knew it was going to be hot. And in those days, you just turned up at the airport. You got a letter. You pick for England. We'll see you at the airport on such and such a day. Don't forget your passport. That was the tour preparation. And you just have to turn up. And I remember thinking, I can't just turn up. It's going to be hot over there. So what I did that winter, I would go in, I would put all my batting gear on, and I'd go and play shots in the local sauna down the leisure centre, which sort of like everyone thought I was like totally loopy. And the local television came and filmed it one night, and I got so much stick for being in a sauna with a long sleeve sweater and a helmet on and playing shots and or keeping, just crouching and bending up and down.
Why can't people be more open-minded about this sort of thing?
No, exactly. Yeah, you're spot on. So in terms of the technical stuff, I would keep to bowlers on difficult, you know, I'd get on a used pitch somewhere, and I would take balls from whichever bowlers are on that tour. I'd take as many balls as I could. Toughers, you'd be lucky to get an over out of toughers. So if you got a couple of overs out of toughers pre-tour or on a match day, that was like a miracle happening. and you put it in your diary. But I remember going to the West Indies one trip, and Alan Knott at Old Trafford. We were training indoors, and he ordered from David Lloyd once, who was the coach. He said, "I need a ton of sand from the local builder's yard and some plywood." And actually, David Lloyd told him to clear off, because his actual words were, "I haven't got any money in my budget for that." But what we tried to do as much often as we could is replicate the conditions, either indoors or outdoors, and just try and be as quick as. And in the West Indies, you have to stand quite close. So we would do a lot of stuff that was quick stuff, close up to the stumps, like in no man's land, that sort of thing. I'd stand to the quicks like 5 yards instead of like 20. If I was playing with Mark now, I'd say, "Mark, you've got to come and bowl at me. Like, not forever, but just come and bowl me a few overs on the side somewhere, days, you know, in practice, and let me get used to what you do and the way you move it and what you and your." And so I familiarized myself as much as I could. That's all I could do in those days. I mean, we didn't have computers or anything. I didn't see myself play technically until 1985, when we were filmed on BBC's Grandstand on a Sunday afternoon. That's the first time I ever saw myself play. Technically, I could analyse my game, and I've been playing 6 years. Yeah, it's true. No computers.
Do you think, therefore, you had to rely more on sort of coaches? You know, you had to be surrounded by people that you really, really. I'm not saying Mark and Co. don't really trust people they check up against the computer, but I mean, did you? You know, who were the sort of influential people around you then that you would talk to? Because as well, you know, if you're a batter, there's other batters to talk to. If you're a keeper in a team, you know, you don't necessarily have another sort of sounding board, do you? So who would you talk to about what you were doing?
If you're lucky, the team, the guy you were keeping with at that club, you would work together, you would do that, and you would sort of help each other a bit. The biggest thing I used to do, as soon as the fixtures came out at the start of the season, like the first two games, first two fixtures I would look for, and in those days, sometimes we played counties twice, I would look for Kent and I would look for Derbyshire, because I meant I could go and knock on the dressing room door at Kent and speak to Mr. Alan Knott. And if I could speak to Mr. Knott for an hour, that was like gold dust for me, or Bob Taylor. I'd get a knock on the dressing room door and say, "Bob, can you spare 10 minutes, you know, and have a chat to him." And those guys were like amazing, you know. So we used to speak to the other keepers. That's all you had. We didn't have keeping coaches or anything. I mean, we had one coach at Gloucestershire that coached the whole club, including the youth teams, the whole lot from top to bottom, and watch the test matches and just try and copy some of the things that they did to try and put them into my game. And basically, you had to be self-sufficient.
We've got, or we did for a long time, we had Bruce French as the wicketkeeping coach. And Frenchie would keep to me when I was bowling if the wicketkeeper was off batting or whatever. And he just, his hands, I remember thinking, he was just so natural. Even when he was like in his 60s, he would just catch it. And I would just think, it just makes it look easy, do you know what I mean? He would just catch the ball and make it look so easy. I know you've mentioned them guys. Is there anyone nowadays who you think, oh, they're a good keeper, or anyone you particularly, or something you see in somebody and you think, oh, that's really good?
I think we're so lucky now. I can just sit back in the armchair now with me slippers on, and if I smoked a pipe, I'd have my pipe on, and I just watching these young lads doing such brilliant business. It's like, you know, we don't have to worry about that department for quite a while now, because the last few years have been brilliant. We had Matt Pryor before. We had James Foster at one point. Stewie was before that. So it's sort of, we've been so blessed with the keepers that we've had. And now that Joss and Johnny are doing it, you know, it's just, I'm loving every minute of it. And now that Ben's come back in, Folks is back in, who is really, and this is no disrespect to any of the keepers, he's easily the most natural keeper in the world. There's no question about that. The guy is just naturally gifted. And got a very simple. I did some radio with him on 5 Live and just chatting to him about keeping. You know, his philosophy is very simple, and he's just such a talented kid. He can bat as well. That's the other thing. He's a top batter as well. He's no mug. But I just think with that department, we are just so blessed. We've got young James Bracey, who's at my old club Gloucester, in the wings there. He's working his way through the Lions teams and being part of the England setup occasionally. So he's a really good, talented young kid. So I'm loving every minute, and I want to see whoever's doing that job do well, you know.
When you were touring, would you have that same relationship with other keepers as you did with keepers on the county circuit? I mean, if you were in the West Indies or India or whatever, would you take some time to talk to their keepers?
Yeah, you would. And if I was on tour, it was mainly with Alex Stewart, so we would work together. I mean, a lot of people thought we never got on. It's not true. We're actually the best of mates. Although we used to play county games and have slanging matches with each other and sledge each other and like have fights on the field almost. And people used to think we hated each other, but actually we were just winding everybody up. And he was great when he was captain at Surrey, because when I was captain at Gloucester for a year, we tossed the coin up. We won't bother wandering out to the pitch, Stu. Just toss the coin up on the balcony, shall we? So we tossed the coin, and the bloody coin came up halfway up the skirting, so it was like on its side, so it wasn't like a head or a tail. So we sort of like, oh, should we have best of three? So we just did best of three on the toss for a county game. And we did it every time we played. We played against him. He was great. So Stu and I would work a lot together. You know, he was my roommate for a bit. I've got to say, he's the world's worst nightmare for me as a roommate, because his side of the room was so tidy and so precise. And mine was like a bomb site. It was like a building site. Kit everywhere. Half the room was all my paints were everywhere. There were pictures taped to the paintings, taped to the walls. In the end, he had to put a piece of tape all the way down the room, the centre of the room, and said, "You do not come this side of the room. Anything comes this side of the room, it goes out the window." He said, "That includes your hat." So him and I were like, he was a nightmare to room with, because he was so bloody tidy. It was difficult for me. But in answering your question, Miles, eventually I will answer it. We did speak to the opposition keepers at some various points, yeah. The Aussies, we would tend to sort of do that. I only played one trip down there. We'd do that at the end. You know, we'd get together at the end generally. But your keepers, we're nutcases anyway. Mark Italia is sort of, we think we're on another planet from everybody else, and we just do our own thing, and we sort of think slightly different, and you've got to be slightly crazy, a bit like goalkeepers. I tell you what I used to do. I used to talk to goalkeepers quite a lot whenever I could. And actually, when I finished playing, I actually went and helped out at my local Forest Green Rovers football club. We were in the non-league. They're in the fourth division now, the old fourth division. So they're a league team there. And I used to go there, and I spent 2.5 years being assistant to the keeping coach and just like in getting involved with goalkeeping. So that was great fun as well. So I used to say, anyone mad enough to keep anything, like goal or anything, I would talk to them.
Right. Well, it is time for Mark Wood's Super Over. The rules are, Jack, don't think, just speak. Okay. I don't know if that's an MO that you can...
That's dangerous.
Okay.
90 seconds, Miles. Are you ready?
90 seconds. Only Mark's going to say, go.
Right, Jack. Turning pitch or green top?
Turning pitch.
Favourite TV dog?
Basil Brush.
The last photo you took or painting?
The World Cup final.
Yes, great show. Favourite cricket ground?
It's got to be Lord's.
If a duck flew at you, would you duck or fight back?
Well, no, I'd fight back.
Steam room or sauna?
It's been such a long time, sauna.
Nice work. Can you build a fire?
Not without firelight or matches, no.
What's the heaviest thing you've ever dropped on your foot?
A lawnmower.
What's the worst thing you've been bitten by?
Oh, God. My wife.
Miles is stealing apples. Last one. Miles is stealing apples from your garden. What do you shout at him?
Clear off.
By the barest of all margins. By the barest of all margins.
That was exactly 90 seconds. Very good. Yeah, I might go. I wouldn't mind a bit of scrumping. Jack, I must say, absolute pleasure to speak to you today. Thanks very much indeed for agreeing to speak to me and Mark. We should come to your gallery, perhaps, and see you in the flesh when the war is over.
Yeah, you're all very welcome. When we can get back to some normality, you're all very welcome. And it's been great to... You've given me... a few minutes away from the canvas, so I've given my eyes a bit of a rest, and my vocal cords have had a bit of a run out, which they don't normally get when I'm in the studio. So it's been great to talk to you guys, and best wishes with everything, and look after yourselves.
Thanks, Jack. Take care.
That is great. I would say Jack Russell, that is, you know, he's one of the sort of the icons of what I think of as my period of cricket. He's great, isn't he?
He's very modest as well. He kept saying, you know, with my limited batting ability. This is the guy that hooked Curtly Ambrose for four. I mean, I'm telling everybody that.
But also, he did that. He had that. We didn't even ask him about that leave, that sort of very characteristic leave. That, you know, not like the sort of theatrics of Steve Smith. It was a kind of an organic sort of aspect to it. But he, you know, he achieved extraordinary things as a Test cricketer. But then also, when after he finished playing for England, he went when he went back to sort of Gloucestershire, he almost sort of reinvented himself in a sort of one-day mode. They were a really successful one-day side. I mean, he would have played, because we forget how early T20 started as well. He played T20 or 2020 games, as it would have been then. But to be honest, the last thing I think I'll think about before I go to sleep tonight is him in full batting gear in a sauna.
To be fair to him, though, right, everything he spoke about, watching the other keepers going to the side screen, preparing like that, he was a bit ahead of his time because they obviously didn't have the analysis and stuff. And he obviously was very watchful and picked up things. I mean, the fact that he was in this steam room, can you imagine, like, Tommy, will you whack a bit more water on the coals there, pal? And would you mind throwing some left-arm spin?
Yeah.
In your rub.
Yeah. Can you open the door and take your full run up? Yeah. No, a fantastic cricketer. And you did very well to keep calm when he was talking about Athers as well, Mark.
Yeah, and he's the super rover. I mean, worst thing you've been bitten by me wife.
Well, I mean, there's a lot to unpack there. That thing, I quite like that, his frog leaping up the stairs as well. I didn't. Cut like to have gone. I wanted to know, because also, if that's, you know, at the moment in lockdown, you're sort of looking for ways to keep fit that don't necessarily involve leaving the house. And I wonder if he would he sort of do frog jumps up the stairs, like whenever he went upstairs, or he would set aside a time of the day, he goes, right, 3:30, I'm going to do 20 minutes on the stairs, or would he be, you know, oh, look, do you want me to go and take these up to the attic, darling? And she would go, please, no, not if that's how you're going to be getting up the stairs.
Not the Christmas decorations. Please, put them down. They're not even bubble wrapped. That shouldn't be no good for you, though, Miles. Not with your offies.
Oh, goodness. No, not. I, you know, when I go down at the leisure centre where the sauna is there, if there's no one around, then I will... I put on the Monmouth kit and I just said practice, you know. I mean, I'm never going to be asked to bowl more than one over, I would have thought. So I've got to build up to it gently. But that, I mean, who knows what the climate with global warming? Who knows what sort of conditions I'm going to be playing in when I'm finally given the ball?
I loved him. Great guest.
Very good.
Thank you, everyone, for listening, and thanks to Jack Russell, absolute legend. Miles, I'll see you next time. Thanks again. Check us on all the social platforms, and we'll catch you again soon.
Oh, should be taken, and is taken. Brilliant from Mark Wood. What a spell this has been.
Middle Please Umpire is an Electric production in association with Playback Media.
For all the latest cricket betting markets, in-play odds and promotions, visit williamhill.com or download the free app. 18 plus, please gamble responsibly. William Hill, it's who you play with.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper? A woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver. I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.